Morning, everybody. If I haven't yet met you, my name is Luke, and it is a privilege to share a message with you as we launch this new series called Gentle and Lowly. Now, if you're a visitor to our church, you might not know this, but for the most part, every year, we spend time working through books of the Bible in our preaching in our Sundays. But every 6 months or so, we take a few weeks to just take a break, and we take one theme or one aspect that we feel that we want to unpack for our church as a people in that particular moment, and we do a series like this one. And this one, in this series, we're looking at the topic or the subject or the theme of what is Jesus really like? What is Jesus really like? Are we talking about the nature of Jesus? Many of us know what Jesus has done. Many of us could recite and tell us what Jesus has done, but what's his heart really like? Maybe more than that, what is Jesus' heart toward you? What is Jesus' heart toward you? How does Jesus, strange question, how does Jesus feel about you or toward you? How does Jesus feel toward you? It's a strange question. I wonder if any of you have even thought it relevant. Dane Ortlund wrote this book several years ago, called Gentle and Lowly. And what he's doing is he's taking some of the scholarly work of those who have come before, some of the Puritans a couple of hundred years ago, who delved deep into some particular scriptures that speak about the nature of Christ. And he's put together these little sort of mini expositions and applications of these scriptures in this book. And I found it to be so life-giving and such a refreshing window into what Jesus is like. And so in this series, we're going to track with many of these texts. Oh, hello. We nearly lost everything there. Not quite, but let's tighten this up. That woke me up. This revelation of who Jesus is. So how does Jesus feel toward you? In particular, how does Jesus feel towards you when you blow it? When you mess up? When you disappoint him, when you let yourself, even your own standards of yourself, let alone his understandings, what is Jesus' feelings toward you when you blow it? And I know it sounds like a strange kind of, to some of us anyway, feely kind of question. What's the relevance of this? But this matters because it matters more than you think, because especially in the moments where you need Christ, we all need Christ in every moment, but the moments where we almost need him the most, how we believe Jesus feels towards us very often determines the extent and the manner in which we engage with him or don't. The extent and the manner to which we engage with his church, our brothers and sisters, or we don't. Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, and that can really create distance for some of us. Jesus is perfect. We are far from perfect. And so again, we can feel a sense of disconnect and distance. But perhaps there's something that you might identify with that I certainly do. As human beings, we very often project onto others how we feel ourselves and the way we feel about ourselves. We can even project onto Jesus the way we perceive him to be toward us. We mess up, we blow it, and often we're very hard on ourselves. And we project that onto Jesus. We can often think that Jesus is towards us the same way that we are towards us. And this determines the extent and the way in which we engage or we don't. We're tough on ourselves and we're tempted to avoid Jesus, who we perceive to be the same on us, and we end up with distance. This series is about closing the gap. This series is about intimacy with Christ. This series is about knowing Jesus more. And I want to start today by looking at Matthew chapter 11, three simple verses from this profound chapter, as we look at the series the title of our series, the verse where we get that from, Matthew chapter 11. We'll read from verse 27 to 29. This is Jesus speaking. He says, "All things have been handed over to me by my Father. All things have been handed over to me by my Father. And no one knows the Son except the Father. And no one knows the Father except the Son. And anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." Isn't that incredible? No, all things have been handed over to me by my Father. No one knows the Father except the Son. No one knows the Son except the Father, except those whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Then Jesus says to us, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Let's take a look at these scriptures. Verse 27, Jesus says this, all things have been handed over to me by my Father. Verse 27 and 28, they give us, in a sense, a window into Trinitarian relationships. I mean, this is mysterious to us. Trying to understand the Trinity, it seems very mysterious, yet there are some things we can learn here. Jesus says, the Father has handed, all things have been handed to me by my Father. There's obviously a relationship of trust, of generosity, of partnership, of shared mission. It's familial, Father and Son. Jesus says, no one knows the Father except the Son. No one knows the Son except the Father. They know one another. The Greek word for this, I'm not going to read it to you, you won't remember it, but the Greek word here means directly translated to know exactly, to know experientially through direct relationship. To know exactly. No one knows the Father except the Son. Just as a little aside here, one of the things I'm sure some of us perhaps struggle with, and I know I struggled with at one stage as well, relevant to Easter, this kind of objection to Christianity that I really think this verse helps us with is the sense in which Christianity can actually be, and Dawkins used these words, he used the word, it's like cosmic child abuse. That we can have this perspective of the Father sending the Son, and there's this firm, resolute, distant Father sending his Son to go and do this horrifically difficult thing on the cross. And we can see this as really as a form of abuse. Dawkins articulated, I struggled with it as well at times. But you read a scripture like this, and you can see where a thought like that kind of falls down, where it doesn't make sense. Because I think it's another place we project our relationships with our parents and our human relationships onto the Trinity. And although the Father and the Son are in fact two distinct persons, what we miss in that is how intimately they know and love and are connected to one another. They know each other so much. And so although they are distinct persons, they are also so united. They know and they love each other so closely that their plans and their wills are in such a way that they're not so disconnected. One making the other one do this very difficult thing as much as it's hearts united. It's ours. It's our plan in a sense. And so we get a window into the Trinity here. We see it's not these two disconnected. It's intimate. It's knowing one another. It's loving each other. It's a closeness that goes both ways, Father to Son, Son to Father. And then Jesus says something astonishing. And anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him, this invitation to know God. Jesus invites you and he invites me to know him. Jesus is implying that you and I may know him too, which is so profound. And then Jesus continues and says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden. The picture here is of an ox who is laboring and is carrying on his shoulders a yoke. And our yoke is not just, in this instance, something inside of an egg, but a yoke is a piece of wood over the shoulders of oxen, maybe tying two together and comes down. My dad, I remember when I was 4 or 5, my dad built a bar. And for however he found it, he found a yoke. And it was this long piece, almost like a gum pole, with these pieces of wood you would drop in, which would sit across the neck here and would be able to put on an animal, and they would tow together and they would be able to pull this plow. And Jesus says, come to me, all you who carry this weight, who are heavy laden. We carry loads as human beings. Some of those loads are hurts, losses, loved ones we've lost who've passed. Relationships that come to an end. Hopes that we had that never materialized. And the disappointments that they carry with them. They can weigh on us. Struggles of our loved ones. Gavin Fish was preaching earlier in the year and he said something. He said, a parent is never happier than their least happy child. You know, these things weigh on us. A child can be also laboring as your parents are aging, and it weighs on your soul. It weighs on your heart. We struggle with our friends. We struggle with hurts. We struggle with hang-ups. hang-ups, things that we can't shake off. We struggle, many of us in our modern world, with depression, with anxiety. Forbes.com put it at between 20 and 33% of people are battling with anxiety disorders. And if you're young, it's even more prevalent. Nearly as much as 50% of those between the ages of 18 and 24 are reporting depressive disorders and anxiety symptoms. This seems to be very prevalent in our modern world. We battle with hurts. We battle with hang-ups. We battle with habits as well, even sinful ones, habits we're trying to shake, things that we bring with us into our faith from our family of origin, from our ways of doing things, habits and pathologies, and these things we wish we could shape. We don't want to pass them onto our kids, and sometimes we end up doing it anyway, and these things weigh on us as human beings. These are weights, these are burdens, the burdens of being human in a modern world. And Jesus says, "You who are heavy laden, come to me. Come to me." And what will Jesus do? He'll take away your burden. No, that's not what it says. That's not what it says. He says, "I will give you rest. I will give you rest. Come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest." Isn't that incredible? But do we come to him? Do we take his yoke upon our shoulders? And I say to you, I think it depends on how you perceive Jesus. I think it depends on how you perceive Jesus' heart towards you, which is why Jesus tells us his heart towards him. He says, "This is my disposition toward you, for I am gentle and lowly in heart." For I am gentle and lowly in heart. These two adjectives, these two profound words that describe the heart of Jesus. Jesus' heart toward you in your brokenness, in your heavy laden, in your sinfulness, in your suffering, in the worst parts of who you are. There's amazing parts of who you are. We're saints, but we're also still struggling with sin and hardship. We're living in the already, but also in the not yet. Jesus' disposition towards you can be described in these two words. For I am gentle and I am lowly in heart. I don't know about you, but I struggle to reveal my heart to other people. Like I'm not like good at talking about what's inside of me. You know, I'm learning. Hey, babe, you say I'm learning, hey? I am learning. There's a fear in us as human beings. When we really expose ourselves to other people, what if they don't like me? Even the good parts of me, what if they don't like me? You know, there's a vulnerability that comes in our lives. What if they see me and they turn away from me? In this passage, Jesus is, in a sense, self-disclosing. If you were to say to Jesus, "You've only got two words you can choose to describe your heart towards me," Jesus says, I'll tell you, this is who I am. My heart is gentle and lowly. The Bible uses the word heart not just to mean your kind of emotional seat. It is there, but it's more than that. It's not merely or only your emotional life. As much as it's Jesus saying, this is the core of who I am. This is my source of desire. It's my source of motivation. It's the place where my, if you will, drivenness comes from. It's what gets me out of bed. It's what matters the most to me. And Jesus chooses two words to describe the very essence of his heart. And he chooses gentle and lowly. Not firm and fair. What's Jesus' disposition towards you and your struggling and your brokenness? Not firm and fair. Not disappointed and demanding. Gentle and lowly. Who would have dreamt up those two words? I mean, you're trying to create a God, let's say, let's create a God and we'll da, da, da. Would you have chosen gentle and lowly? Let's explore, what do these two words mean? Gentle. The Greek word for gentle occurs three times in the New Testament, and I'm going to put all three instances up here, and you'll see each time it's translated with subtle different variations, but we'll get the picture of what's being said here. And the word gentleness here, Matthew 5, verse 5, in the Beatitudes, Jesus says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The word gentle here, translated as meek, tamely submissive, word meek means, but you get the idea of meekness. Blessed are the gentle, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Matthew 21, verse 5, say to the daughter of Zion, "Behold, your king is coming to you, humble and riding on a donkey." The word gentle has an essence of humility. We sang humbleness. Is that a word? I'm not sure, but it rhymed with the word before in the song. Matthew 1 Peter 3, verse 4, "But let your adorning be of the hidden person of the heart, with imperishable beauty, of a gentle and quiet spirit, in which God's sight is very precious." This word gentle is summed up in three kind of translations here, if you will: meek, humble, and gentle. Jesus disposition to you in your moments of need, in your lowest moments, is meek and humble and gentle, not harsh and reactionary, not easily angered, not patient up to a point and then. Jesus is the most understanding person in all of the universe. His posture to us is not a shaking head. It's not a wagging finger. It's arms open wide saying, come to me. Come to me. He is gentle. He is lowly. Now, this is an interesting one. I mean, of all the words we look at today, probably this is the one that's most blurry to us, right? What does lowly even mean? To start with, it overlaps a bit with gentle. It overlaps. It's translated as humble often in the New Testament as well. James 4, verse 6. Remember 2 years ago, we worked through the book of James. But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. To the lowly. The specific emphasis, though, within humility, it's not just the virtue here of humility as much as it just describes someone who's been pushed down, someone who's been squeezed and squashed and pressed by life's circumstances, someone who is lowly. And we best see it perhaps described in Mary's song as she declares of God in Luke chapter 1. Verse 51 to 53, he has shown strength with his arm, God. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate, those who are lowly, those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with good things and the rich he has sent away empty. Speaking of the socially unimpressive, those who are not the life of the party, perhaps those for whom the host of the party cringes a little bit when they come because you've got some explaining to do to the other cool people in the crowd, right? Imagine I was to say to you, right, every one of you, here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I want you to confess your deepest, darkest secrets to one of two people who are waiting in the prayer room over there. You get to choose which one, though. There's two people waiting there. You're going to share your deepest, darkest secret with one of them. The first one is immaculately dressed, incredibly beautiful, and tremendously wealthy. The other is poorly dressed, a bit disheveled in the corner, looking worse for wear, and sitting awkwardly over there. Who are you going to choose? Invariably, we're going to choose the one who's lowly, who's more approachable. And this is what Dane Ortlund so well gets at. The idea of the lowliness of Jesus is there to communicate to us the approachability, the accessibility of Jesus. Dane Ortlund says this in the book. He says, for all his resplendent glory and dazzling holiness, his supreme uniqueness and otherness, we sang of holy, holy, holy are you this morning. No one, for all of that truth, no one in human history has ever been more approachable than Jesus Christ. No one in human history has ever been more approachable than Jesus Christ. No prerequisites, no hoops to jump through. All that is required is two things. Number one, that we be heavy laden. There's no fees to pay, there's no duty to thing, no hoops to jump through, just that we be heavy laden and weary, and secondly, that we come to him. We open ourselves up to him because Jesus is gentle and lowly, and he is gentle and lowly all the way down. He is gentle and lowly all the way down. His gentleness is not overcome by the size of our sinfulness. His gentleness is not overcome by the size of your sinfulness. He is consistently gentle and lowly, not sometimes gentle, sometimes not. His gentleness is simply who he is. He can no more change his disposition of gentleness and lowliness than you and I can change our eye color. It is simply who Jesus is. It's worth noting he's not like this indiscriminately. He's gentle and lowly to those who come looking for help. The very paragraph we're looking at in Matthew chapter 11, the paragraph before this, Jesus' last little encounter just before this one in Matthew, describes Jesus' response to the arrogant, the self-righteous. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works had been done in you that had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you that it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. Gentle and lowly does not mean wet blanket. Gentle and lowly to those who come to him. And what do we find when we come to him? We find rest for our souls. Not our bodies. Just give up and stop every effort and just let go and let God. Yeah, there's instances where that's definitely partially true. But the Christian life is still one of labor. The Christian life is still one of effort. But the Christian life is one of labor and effort that comes in response to being loved so profoundly well. It's a labor and effort that comes from being loved by Christ. It's like when Lauren loves me in her very best way, I don't just give up and say, well, then I'm not doing anything because I'm loved. No. Everything in me then wants to respond to her in love as well. And so, yes, the Christian life is one effort. The Christian life is one of labor, but it's labor that's almost birthed in response to Christ's incredible goodness and love given to us. And so Jesus says to us, come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest, for my yoke is easy. But is Jesus trying to put another weight on us then? Is Jesus putting a yoke on us again? Is this another weight to take on? Except Jesus says, for my yoke is easy. The same word easy can also mean kind. My yoke is kind. Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another. It could be translated, be easy to one another, in the sense of don't be difficult with each other. Be easy with each other and tender-hearted. Jesus' yoke is easy. Imagine with me that there was a person who was drowning in the sea, covered in all your clothes, your heavy, dressed for today, winter clothes in the water, weighing down by all these clothes. And I come to you and I say, put this jacket on, this life jacket on you. And you say, no ways, I'm not putting that life jacket on. These clothes are heavy enough as it is. This is the sense in which I think we come to the understanding of yoke. No. This life jacket is going to hold you up. This yoke is going to buoy you up. It's like helium in your balloons, right? It's the sense in which it carries you along. Jesus' yoke is so kind to us. We take it on, and yet it saves us and renews us and energizes us and transforms us. Makes sense so far? I know today we're taking a simple idea, but I'm trying to bring it to bear on our hearts in a way in which I think many of us would say, yeah, I've heard that, but do you know that to the core of your being in the moments where you absolutely need it the most? I think maybe sometimes our greatest need as Christians is not some new thing, but it's just knowing the things we already know and the way in which they profoundly anchor our souls. Maybe you think, yeah, Luke, I know this. I've heard this about Jesus. But when you come to Jesus, you think he kind of like holds his nose a little bit. Come to me. Well, he touches you like a little child touches a frog. Okay. I'll come to him, but Jesus doesn't hold his nose when you come to him. He doesn't tolerate you because he has to. Because he is gentle and lowly of heart. He is the most approachable being in all the universe. His arms are open wide. He longs for you to come to him. Not just your best days. This is his disposition to those who are weary and those who are heavy laden, those who are sinners and those who are sufferers. He says, come to me. And I think we struggle to accept this. We struggle to believe this about Jesus for a couple of reasons. One is I actually don't think we like gentle and lowly. I think we value different things. We aspire to greatness instead of servanthood in our generation. I am the greatest, we sing, right? We elevate confidence instead of humility. You know, if you're to be a leader of a movement, no, you need a presence about you. When you walk in the room, you must command the attention of the room. That's what we like on the front covers of our magazines and et cetera, right? Imagine we were to launch a movement and we were to put together a job description for a prospective leader. And the highest character trait No, no, he must be gentle. She must be gentle and lowly. Have you ever seen a job description like that? We don't aspire to these things. We don't value and we prize other things. And yet Jesus says, if you were to make me pick just two adjectives to describe my heart, I'm gentle and I'm lowly. Another reason I think we struggle with is, although deep down we wish Jesus was like this toward us and our weakness and our brokenness, I think to the person here, we all do. It's just so foreign that it can feel too good to be true. Our world is such a meritocracy. You get what you deserve. It's eye for an eye. What I put in, that's what I get out. That we just think, when I bring my sinfulness, when I bring my suffering, when I bring my brokenness, when I bring my weary and heavy ladenness, it must be met with the same. And it's not. It seems too good to be true. So if I can maybe just conclude, I want to wash over us a couple of things. Almost like, have you ever taken, maybe you've done this, I painted an item of furniture in our house that's a dark item with light paint. Have you ever done that? I'm always surprised at how many coats of paint it actually needs before you can stop seeing that stuff through, right? I want to almost just paint a few coats over us this morning as we land. If Jesus is, as we say, gentle and lowly, and we are heavy laden, we struggle with sinfulness, we struggle with suffering, we bring in hurts, habits, hang-ups, and Jesus is gentle and lowly, and we can come to him, what can we expect in his response to us? I'll tell you, time after time, we see Jesus' response in the scriptures. Take a look with me. Time after time, when someone in brokenness comes to Jesus, look at Jesus' heart's response. Matthew chapter 8, verse 1 to 3. Large crowds followed Jesus as he came down the mountainside, and suddenly a man with leprosy. Suddenly a man with leprosy approached him and knelt before him. Lord, the man said, if you are willing, if you even want to, you can heal me and make me clean. Jesus reached out and he touched him. Didn't even need to do that, maybe. He reached out and he touched him. He said, I am willing, be healed. And instantly the leprosy disappeared. Jesus' heart comes through in his actions towards those who are broken. Matthew chapter 9. Verse 35, Jesus traveled through the towns and the villages of that area, teaching in the synagogues, announcing the good news about the kingdom. He's preaching the gospel, and he healed every kind of disease and illness. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were confused and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. If Jesus is gentle and lowly, and we come to him in our brokenness and weariness, what response do we see time after time? What response can you and I expect from him? Compassion. Compassion and empathy. Time after time. In this here, he had compassion on them. It's as if Jesus saw the helplessness of the crowd and his heart was moved towards them. His the core of his being, the gentle and lowliness of Jesus drew him to action here. His heart is moved into action, and the church, if you will, those who are seeking, were met with wave after wave of compassion. His miracles were, they weren't just kind of like party tricks to draw a crowd. That, in part, miracles in a sense are reaching into the future of what's going to happen when Christ returns and bringing it now into the present to taste and see, this is what I'm doing. I'm beginning it now. It's going to be completed then. Yes, but it is also just the immediate response of a gentle and lowly heart when confronted with a broken and needy person who comes to him. It's the welling up of compassion in him. Matthew chapter 14, as soon as Jesus heard the news, he left in a boat to a remote area to just be alone. Have you ever been there? I just need a break. I can't deal anymore. Please, children, I need a break, whatever. Friends, work, whatever it is. Have you ever been there? I just need a break. But the crowds heard where he was and headed and followed on foot from many towns. What did Jesus do? Turned his back because he really needed a rest. Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. He's trying to get away. He's trying to get some downtime, some me time, if you will, today's language. And yet his heart is overridden with compassion as he healed and cared for his people. So much of what Jesus did was a gentle and lowly heart welling up in a compassionate and empathetic response to those who were marginalized and hurting and broken. Last one, Matthew 15. The crowd was amazed, verse 31. Those who hadn't been able to speak were talking. The crippled were made well. The lame were walking. And the blind could see again. And they all praised the God of Israel. Then Jesus called his disciples and told them, I feel sorry for these people. One translation. I feel sorry for these people. They've been here with me for 3 days and they have nothing left to eat. I don't want to send them away hungry or they'll faint along the way. And so what did he do? He fed thousands of people in a miracle. It was the welling up of compassion. I feel for these people. I have empathy and compassion towards these. The Greek word for compassion, the same in all of these texts, refers to something that wells up from within our bowels, our very bowels. I realized what I just said there. You get the humorous side of it, but you also know in your life when you see something that is just so, it draws out of you the very best parts of what it means to be human, and it almost commands a response because of your nature, even more than their need. This is Christ. It's compassion. When we read the Gospels, we can't help but see that Jesus' heart of gentle and lowliness overflows time after time in compassion. Jesus is moved to care for and minister to broken and needy people in society. The cumulative testimony of the Gospels, time after time, is that the deepest impulse of Christ, his most natural instinct, is to move towards sin and suffering and to bring healing and life to us there. And this is what you and I can come to Christ with. To put it all together as we land, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, for I am gentle and I am lowly. I am approachable. I am accessible. And when you come to me in your brokenness, when you stop hiding, when you stop pretending, when you stop facading that you've got it all together, and you come to him as you are, you can expect compassion. And remember, as we started in verse 27, the first invitation of Jesus. You will get to know him there. No one knows the Father, no one knows the Son, except whom those the Son. And Jesus is drawing us in to know him. We must land. Can we stand together? And can I lead us in prayer? What is Jesus really like? I mean, to his core, to the deepest part of his very being. If you were to ask Jesus, many things have been said about him by other people, but what is Jesus? What is his very heart like toward sinners and sufferers like you and like me? He says to you, I'm gentle. In your moment of need, in your place of shame, in your brokenness, through things that you've done, through things that have been done to you, through things that have happened in your life that have broken your soul, if you were. You're heavy laden. Jesus says, what should you do? He says, come to me, come to me, come to me. Don't pretend, don't clean up, don't minimize. Just come to me, not on the basis of who you are and what you've done, but on the basis of who I am, for I am gentle and I am lowly. I am approachable, I am humble, I am kind. Come to me. And what can you expect when you come to me? Compassion. For I want you to be whole. I want you to be healed. But in order that, I want you to know me. I want you to know the Father. You are not an orphan on this pilgrimage through life waiting for Jesus to take you home. You can know him. You can be held by him. You can bring all your junk. And you can come to him, arms open wide.